Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How spontaneous are you? Is it possible that a mathematical formula might predict many of our behaviors? And if so, what can we learn from that ability to guess how human beings tend to organize their lives? Albert Laszlo Barabasi is founding director of the Center for Network Science at Northeast University. A few years ago, looking over reams of email usage data from thousands of people, he made a remarkable discovery. Rather than addressing our communications at random throughout our weeks, by and large, we all work in predictable bursts, letting hours or even days pass with little activity, and then suddenly answering or initiating numerous messages in a flurry. Barabasi's latest book, out now in trade paperback, is called Bursts, The Hidden Patterns Behind Everything We Do, from your email to bloody crusades. Laszlo, welcome to Think.
It's a pleasure being here.
It's so interesting because we've become quite adept at understanding the rules and laws of the physical world. Why has it taken us this long to find ways to predict human behavior?
Well, it's all about data. If you think what science has done in the last 200 years is that we really perfected the tools. You know, we made telescopes essentially to look at the stars and collect data about the stars. We made microscopes to be able to look at, like cells and microscopic objects. And what we missed, essentially, is data about ourselves. There's lots of reason why we're not comfortable actually collecting data about ourselves. You know, we're perfectly okay to look under the microscope and follow what the bacteria do or at the moon, but, you know, we're not always comfortable of having ourselves seen in that terms. But at the end, you know, we really lack hard data about what we do on a daily basis.
And part of that, I guess, is because we assume that we're just too complicated to be predicted.
Part of it. So there are lots of forces that actually kind of converge there. One of them was just simply the difficulty of really collecting objective data about what we do. And on the other hand, we also assume that we know what we do. So therefore, you know, we didn't think that we need to use the tools of hard sciences to look at human behavior because it's enough to simply sit at a street corner and observe what people do.
So several years ago, you were granted access to this very large anonymous digital database, which was a record of emails sent by university students and staff. What sorts of ideas were you looking to test when you got all this data into your lab?
Well, there were two questions we were after. I mean, we came from the perspective of trying to understand how networks, how networks work, who is connected to whom, who is communicating with whom. And that has been the research area that I've been pursuing actually in the last 10 years. Well, we became increasingly interested not only knowing who are your friends and how often we communicate with them, but what is the particular temporal pattern of your communication. That is, when do you send an email? When do you make a phone call? What is the precise time? And what is the relationship between the precise times of the different interactions?
And you found these things called bursts. Can you talk about how you define that in relation to this work?
Sure. Before we actually talk about bursts, we should talk about what was the expectation. Where do we start it from?
Okay.
And the expectation was that I don't really know what motivates you, what decides, you know, based on which you actually decide when to send the next email, you make the phone call, and so on. And therefore, the best assumption we can make is that your activity pattern, from my perspective, is exactly random. Because, you know, you could be sending an email in the next 10 minutes, or you could be sending an hour from now, or maybe next day. So given that I don't know your motivations, a random model should describe that process. And this was not only our assumption. You know, it turns out that much of the communication systems that we have today, from the phone system to the email system, is based on the assumption and is built on the assumption that people make phone calls randomly, send emails randomly, browse the web randomly. Now, if our calls are random, if our emails are random, then it means that the timing of these emails, not only they are random, but there is some uniformity of that. Because at any moment, you have the same chance of sending an email, whether it's the next 5 minutes or a day from now and so on. And that gives a certain degree of uniformity, some boringness, essentially, to your email pattern. If I were to look at the random signal, it would just look like randomly placed lines a long time.
Mm-hmm.
What we found instead is that this random uniformity was completely absent from the people's communication pattern. Rather, we saw short periods of very intensive activities, lots of phone calls, lots of emails taking place within 20 minutes, half an hour, and so on. And then long period of nothingness, that nothing happened, as if the person really gave up email or phone or so on. And this was a recurrent pattern, not for one person or for the other one, but for everybody, and not only for email, but for all type of, let's say, human activity patterns that we had a chance to look at. So essentially, human communication really happens in bursts. There are short periods of very intense activity and long periods of not much happening.
So what do you think could be the reason for that?
Well, there are, the reasons were so obvious to find right away because, at the end, you really have to get into the mind of a person. But then we digged actually deeper, and the answer seems to be lying on a very simple thing that we do on a daily basis, which is prioritization. That is that, we don't really decide randomly, of course, what we do things, but anytime we do something, that particular action really competes with lots of other actions that we could be doing at the same moment. You know, if you think about it, at any moment you have a number of activities that you would need to do. You may have to go to the bank, you may, call your friend, you may have to respond to an email, you may have to do an interview with somebody, and so on. And what actually gets done to a certain degree depends on a number of factors, including a prioritization that we have in mind or whether we write it down and so on. And so therefore, at any time, the decision whether you make a call or not really competes with the other task on your priority list. What we have found is that if people have a priority list, and as long as they assign priorities that they don't pick the items randomly from the priority list, then there will actually be luckier and less luckier processes. The high-priority projects will actually fly off your list because you will pay attention to them. The low-priority list, the items essentially will stay for a very, very long time on your list. And when you put everything together, then a bursty pattern emerges. Some things will really take place very, very fast. Some things will wait a very, very long time, and they would be responsible for these long waits on your activity pattern.
Yeah, I was thinking about this the other day because I got an email that said that there'd been a problem with my toll tag, which is the thing that we use to get into the airport and to drive on certain roads here. And ordinarily, it takes me a while to get back to emails or to look at things. But this said, you could have your car taken away at the airport if you don't deal with this right now. And so I literally dropped everything. But all the other things on my priority list didn't necessarily stay in front of that. So in other words, I did that first, even though I hadn't known anything about it when I was making the other things, the list of the other things I had to get done that day.
The best way to think about it is that our priority list is never fixed, but actually it's a very dynamic one. This means that we have a certain number of things that we execute based on their priorities, but then new things keep landing on the priority list, and they take up a position relative to the other things. So the example you said is a priority, is a task that came in and got right away high priority, which means that its priority was higher than anything you had, and therefore it got executed right away. And that seems to be actually the pattern that people seem to be doing. So what happens is that there is a tendency for everybody's priority list to actually fill up with low priority tasks because the high priorities we tend to execute. So at any moment, our priority list is full with a bunch of things that we're really dragging our feet on and we don't really want to get to. So every time a new task comes, chances are that that's going to have higher priority than everything else on the list because, you already paid attention to the other high priority tasks. So what you're describing is a very common phenomenon, and actually we see that in the email pattern of individuals. When we actually looked at what order people respond emails, it turns out that there is a very, very high tendency of responding to the emails that you got, and that you got the latest, essentially. So, and that's responsible for this burst, because these are the type of things that come on your list, and then you execute it right away. Another one comes through, execute it right away, and gives you a burst of activity around a certain issue. And then you get to this thing that, okay, I don't have to do this anymore, and that's the long time. So if you want to think in terms of your emails, how many times it happens to us is that we sit down in front of the computer, and there are 35 emails to answer, but four of them are high priority, and the rest can wait. So we respond to those four of one. And then we take a break. Mm-hmm. And that break may be 5 minutes or 2 hours or 2 days. And then next time when we get to the computer, again, a few higher priority things and the low priority things will have to come. what is amazing is that you would think that the pattern, how we respond, and our activity pattern may depend on the details of how we do that. What we find is that as long as you assign priorities, that is, you don't do the first come, first serve, or you don't do a random choice, then you will always have burst the outcome.
You know, what's so fascinating about that is that it sort of explains procrastination, because if there are always things swooping in that seem more important than the things we don't want to get done in the first place, the list of things we're putting off just gets longer and longer.
That's right. And as I said earlier, you know, we can count on the fact that our priority list is full of lots of low priority items. But it also gives us another perspective, and that's what I learned by researching this topic. Is when I send an email to somebody else, it's not, and I don't get a response right away, it's not that that person is not paying attention to me. It just happens that his or her list of priorities has a couple of items that have higher priority than mine. So what I need to do is somehow get my message to have a high priority. So we need to be somewhat understanding, you know, from what happens to our messages when we send, when we leave a phone message or when we call people or when we actually send them an email, is that our message will really compete with a bunch of other ones. And it's not that the person doesn't like us. It just happens to be the other higher priority things on his list, like taking care of the car that may be towed from the airport.
So talk about this, Leslo, because another question that I know you had to ask yourself was, is this just a factor of our high-tech world and our instant communications? So you went back, and there's actually a really good record of correspondence to and from Albert Einstein by what we now call snail mail. Can you talk about that?
Sure. That was a lovely project. We really liked it because, you know, once we have seen this one in emails and phone calls, we really ask the question, as you quoted, is to say, is this only us? Is this like what the electronics does to us? This sense of responding very rapidly, and that gives a chance to burstiness. So then we said, let's go back to a time where there was no email, where there was no computer. How could we get information about the communication patterns of individuals? So then we realized, well, famous people actually have their letters collected. I'm actually sitting in my office right now, and I see about 15 volumes of Charles Darwin correspondence. Mm-hmm. And I have about 10 volumes of Albert Einstein correspondence in my office. What happened is, them being so famous, actually, people have painstakingly collected every single letter they wrote or received. And in some cases, this was a difficult project, like the case of Einstein, because he was really not good at keeping his letters. In case of Charles Darwin, that was actually an easy process, because Darwin has really lived much of his scientific life through his correspondence. He never really held a job. He was independently wealthy. And his main way of communication with other scientists was by letters. And he kept a copy of every letter he wrote. He had a primitive technology by which he really made a carbon copy of all his correspondence. So we know every single letter that he wrote, and we know a high fraction of letters that Einstein has sent or received, particularly after he became famous because people then held on to his letters. So now these letters are dated. So we can explicitly ask a number of questions. What was the time that Einstein and Darwin were sending the letters? Also, we can ask the question, how long did they sit on a letter? Did they respond right away, or did they wait a long time? Which is kind of connected to the burstiness pattern, because the mathematical expression, the so-called power law that we observed for the time between two letters, let's say the response time that it takes for you to respond to my letter, follows this power law, which indicates that most letters should be responded very fast. A few, however, should wait very, very long time.
Let me jump in here for just a minute. We need to take a quick break. My guest is Albert Laszlo Barabasi. He's founding director of the Center for Network Science at Northeastern University. His new book, available now in trade paperback, is called Bursts, The Hidden Patterns Behind Everything We Do, From Your Email to Bloody Crusades. Join us now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is founding director of the Center for Network Science at Northeastern University, Albert Laszlo Barabasi. His book is out now in trade paperback. It's called Bursts, The Hidden Patterns Behind Everything We Do, From Your Email to Bloody Crusades. You can be part of the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. So, Laszlo, you were saying before the break that you wanted to look at these emails by the likes of Darwin and Einstein and find out how long they took to respond and how they prioritized their responses.
That's right. And so these were their letters, actually, not emails. And
excuse me.
And so when we managed to get the data from these archives, then we realized that they followed exactly the same patterns as we do by email today. Most of the letters that Darwin or Einstein received were responded pretty immediately, within a day or two. A few, however, waited weeks and in some cases years. We actually do have evidence from Einstein of letters that were responded from years, and this is not because there were letters lost in between, but Einstein starts out the letter, "I'm sorry, I know that you wrote to me, you know, a year and a half ago on that and that date, but I'm only now getting to respond to you."
Hmm.
So what we saw in action in case of both Einstein and Darwin is that they have used exactly the same type of prioritization that we use today, whether we use it consciously or unconsciously. They were able to stay on top of their correspondence, but occasionally they fell behind, and mathematically they followed exactly the same laws as we see in emails or in mobile phone correspondence.
You had a remarkable, you noticed some remarkable correspondence between Einstein and a younger scientist named Theodore Kaluza, which began before Einstein became world famous thanks to the theory of relativity, but sort of continued after that time.
Oh, that was really a lovely story. So Kaluza was a mathematician and a physicist, living in a small village at the bottom of the academic hierarchy. He got his PhD. And he kind of worked out, after many years of working alone on that, a theory that was related to Einstein's theory of relativity. And then he sent a copy of his theory, of his paper, to Einstein. Now, why would he do that? Well, partly because he was connected to some of his Einstein's work, but partly because back then, the scientific publishing really went through famous scientists. That is, that if Einstein really recommended this letter for publication, then a journal would right away accept it. And if he didn't recommend, obviously Kaluza would have to find somebody else to communicate, as they call that particular paper. Einstein, looked at the paper and he thought that was very interesting because Kaluza was really suggesting that in order to interpret the many physical effects, if you build a theory for that, one would have to assume that our, space is not three-dimensional, but it has many more dimensions. So that was a crazy prediction, but Einstein looked at it first. First, he made some suggestions, sent back the paper to Kaluza to work on it, and then Kaluza reworked those details and sent it back to Einstein. Einstein was very encouraging, saying, okay, a few more details, and then he sent it back to Kaluza for another revision, which was normal. That's how things have happened. In the meantime, however, the British have discovered that the light that really comes from faraway stars is really bended by the our sun,
mm-hmm.
And that was a major discovery. This was happening, at the 10th years of the things were leading up to the Second World War, and it was a truly breakthrough. Science, Einstein really became overnight famous. He became a celebrity, not only famous. All the news around the world, front page of New York Times, was full of the fact that there was this incredible prediction that the light will be bended by the sun, and now that actually been experimentally confirmed. With that, Einstein's life has essentially changed, and he stopped responding to Kaluza. He wrote a terse letter saying, oh, I'm sorry, this is, you still have to work on it, and then essentially dropped the correspondence. So it's a classical case of how, Einstein's priority has suddenly changed. Now, for Kaluza, this was pretty much the end of his professional career. And he really, after Einstein rejected, started to work on other subjects and became a mathematician. He, for all practical purposes, he abandoned physics. And wasn't until 2 years later when Einstein, finally having some time again to himself, started to think about the problem. And then he realized that the way he tried to continue his own research, he needs to use Kaluza's theory. And wasn't until 2 years later that he finally wrote a note to Kaluza saying, you know, I'm now supportive of your paper. Why don't you submit it and we'll have it published? Which Kaluza did, eventually published it. And his theory really became the bedrock of modern quantum mechanics and string theory, what we have today. But it was really delayed many, many years. And not only was delayed many, many years, but pretty much Einstein's lack of priority that assigned to this project later on, you know, after he became famous, destroyed the career of a young scientist.
So I'm assuming that we'll spend much of the rest of this hour talking about how these power laws and this burst behavior affects other kinds of human behavior. Talk first, though, if you would, for a few minutes about other natural phenomena that tend to follow power laws.
Well, power laws are very, very common in a huge number of phenomena. My first encounter of that was when we studied networks, and that is that how many friends a person has, how many other computers does an internet router connect to, how many web pages link the person, a particular web page, like how many people connect to Facebook or how many people connect to Google and so on. And there again, the underlying assumption was that these systems are random and, you know, would people randomly make friends, people randomly connect to each other and so on. And therefore, if that would be the case, we would expect to have this uniform network that most people would have roughly the same number of friends, most web pages will gather roughly the same number of links. Instead, when we started to look at these systems, like the society, like the World Wide Web, and so on, we noticed that there is a huge amount of inhomogeneity, unevenness in these networks. The vast majority of web pages had only one or two or three links pointing to them. There were a few, like Google and Facebook and others, that had hundreds of millions of links pointing at them. In the same in the society, if you look at how many Facebook friends people have, most people have only a few dozen at most. A few, however, have millions of Facebook friends, and the same in Twitter and so on. And it turned out that the same power law distribution was describing this phenomenon and capturing exactly the fact that I told you in words that in these systems you have many, many small events and a few major hubs. That's the same phenomenon that we saw in the burst. You have many, many short inter-event times, that is, you know, emails that follow each other at short time, generating a burst, and then occasionally a long waiting time, which is like a hub of the World Wide Web where you don't do much. But these power laws actually emerge in Ramdorff systems. For example, if you look at how earthquakes, what's the frequency of earthquakes, it turns out that, you know, we have a huge number of earthquakes that we don't really notice too much, because they are very, very small shakings. They have a very small scale, and there are a few that are very, very large. And as a matter of fact, the Richter scale that we always hear, that's a size 1, size 8, or size 9, really kind of captures this power law distribution. You know, when you go from 6 to 7, you are increasing really orders of magnitude the size of the earthquake. So anywhere we look, whether you look at social phenomena, economic phenomena, technological phenomena, and so on, you know, we see these power laws emerging, and typically the best way to think about it is that they predict that there are these outliers, these huge hubs, these very, very long waiting times, you know, these very, very large earthquakes that coexist with many, many small phenomena.
So for every certain number of very tiny earthquakes, there might be one very large one?
That's exactly right. We don't know when it's going to come, but we know that there will be a large one sooner or later down the line. Because what the power law tells us is that how many you should have small ones and how many you should have large ones.
So what do we gain from understanding the natural laws that play into patterns of human activity?
Well, you know, we live in a society that is by no means random. You know, we have an economy, we have a society that really depends on the interactions between the individuals. And to a certain degree, our life depends much more on the society and understanding of the society and economy than depending essentially on how well we understand certain subatomic phenomena. And so therefore, you know, the tools of science have slowly have to turn away from the stars and the atoms and start focusing on the things that really matters to us, which is us. And that's really that our research is part of, is to say, how would you understand human behavior, whether it's social behavior, whether it's economic behavior, whether it's communication patterns, from the perspective of natural sciences, that is relying on data, having predictive power, so that we can do the full spectrum of tools from measurement, discovery, uncovering the laws that govern us, all the way to predicting our behavior, but now not applying to atoms, but applying to us.
So what about things like, as in your subtitle, bloody crusades or wars? We tend to think that there are very, maybe not necessarily logical, but reasons that we can understand, that we can pinpoint for why conflicts begin and why they escalate and why they finally die down. How does that relate to this?
Well, I mean, there are different schools of thought on that. So, for example, there is Karl Popper, a very famous philosopher who really kind of founded the philosophy of science. And he very famously argued in the 1950s and 60s that social phenomena is not predictable. That is that, it's one thing that we talk about atoms and stars and we predict their behavior and the trajectory of different planets and so on, but social phenomena are so inherently complex that we should not even attempt to actually predict them, because they really deviate from all predictive tools. So, wars and crusades were exactly one of those examples, is that we cannot predict when we're going to have the next war and so on. Now, that has been actually a question that's been asked many times over centuries by scientists. And there was one particular scientist from England, and he actually devoted part of his life trying to understand whether we can predict wars and other human conflicts. And he wrote he wrote two books in his life, and there were in many, many ways each of them famous failures. So his name is Richardson, Lewis Richardson, and his first book was about predicting the weather. So this was kind of in 1910, 1920, at which time, there was weather prediction, but the weather prediction had a very interesting form. Always the weatherman would actually gather in London, so he lived in UK, and look at the weather patterns they collected around the country, whether it's raining, whether it's sunny, what's the temperature. And then they would start thinking, did we actually see a similar map, weather map of UK, any time before in the past years? And then, these were people with very good memory, and then one of them said, yes, I remember 3 years and 4 months ago, we actually saw exactly the same weather map. They pulled it out, and they said, that it does match. So how do we predict tomorrow's weather? We look what happened after that day. 4 years ago, and that's what will happen tomorrow. And that worked pretty exactly. It was rather successful, because indeed, if the weather pattern today is a certain shape, if we saw a similar one before, we can assume that things will progress in the same direction. What Richardson assumed is that this can be done scientifically. Weather should be calculated. And by then, the physical laws that govern the motion of atmosphere and temperature changes and so on were discovered. So he developed the mathematics of saying, of how do we predict the weather. And then in his first book, he described his technique, and he tried to predict the weather from the morning weather at 6 a.m. to the noon weather, at a particular day, and his prediction was a complete failure. He was predicting the temperature patterns that were never seen in the UK weather. So he described his methodology nevertheless, and he actually turned out to be right at the same time as being wrong, because he was right that the methodology was correct. What he was wrong about is that he did not have sufficient amount of data and computational power to really predict the future of what will happen with the weather, let's say, 6 hours later. And only with the advent of computers we got there. Now, his second part, coming back to your question, is even more interesting. After finishing with weather prediction, he moved on to predict wars. He collected a huge amount of data about historical events, of what past conflicts took place, and then he collected everything about them, whether people who were fighting, did they have the same religion, the same language, did they live next to each other, and so on, were they Christian, were they Muslim, and so on. And then he arrived to a number of quite depressive conclusions. The first one was most of the wars that he could collect were actually taking place between Christians. The second one is that, and that was pretty much the most shocking for him, there were no patterns that were predictive of conflict. So he then scientifically concluded that wars can really not be predicted. And that was the line of thought that really persisted for decades, and that's a line of thought that is slowly changing right now. In the book, I describe as a story the Crusades of Transylvania of 1514, at least some things are doubted as a crusade, which had a very important element to that, that is somebody has predicted what will happen in these particular events. What I really want to emphasize is that while that particular prediction has an interesting story why they could do that, what is happening right now is that researchers are increasingly finding patterns that allow us to predict whether a certain conflict will take place. For example, last week, Science Magazine has carried an important article by Neil Johnson in which he discovered patterns that foresee how many causalities will actually be in Iraq in a certain day. And he applied the same tools to the conflicts of Afghanistan and other conflicts around the world. So while Richardson's conclusion was there are no patterns, there are no laws when it comes to laws and wars and conflicts, we increasingly see that if you collect enough data about them, there are predictive patterns in them.
So I guess it's a matter of running all the different data points into the computer and figuring out which ones really matter and which ones you can set aside.
Pretty much so, yes, because if you think about it, weather prediction didn't become a reality until we had satellites, until we had data collection methodology to create instantaneously information about our weather around the world globe. In the same way, if we want to predict social phenomenon, we need to be able to connect sufficient amount of data and to process them in the computer such that really prediction in real time is possible.
My guest is Albert Laszlo Barabasi. He's founding director of the Center for Network Science at Northeastern University. His book is called Bursts, The Hidden Patterns Behind Everything We Do, From Your Email to Bloody Crusades. Join our conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send an email or a burst of emails to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Albert Laszlo Barabasi, founding director of the Center for Network Science at Northeastern University and author of Bursts, The Hidden Patterns Behind Everything We Do, From Your Email to Bloody Crusades. Join in by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Leslie, what have we learned by studying these large data sets about the way we move around in the world?
Well, a lot, but before that, let's talk about how do we know where we move around the world.
Okay.
Well, you know, most of us these days carry a mobile phone, and we don't think much about it, but if you kind of think for a second, you have to realize that in order for the mobile phone company to ring your phone when somebody tries to reach you, they need to know roughly where you are. That is, what in the vicinity of which tower you can be found at a certain moment. And indeed, our mobile phone checks in every 15 minutes with the company, pretty much telling the closest tower, here am I, in case you need to call me, this is where you're going to find me. This collects a huge amount of information about our location, you know, our time reserve location. And by working with mobile phone companies, we got access to data like this, anonymously. We didn't know who the people are. We didn't know their phone number. For us, all these people were just particles that diffused apparently around the space. That is that, you know, there were little dots like atoms. And what our question was is really, how do we describe mathematical this process? And, you know, is this particular mobility random or it follows some particular laws? Now, nobody's mobility is random, because if I go somewhere, if I know exactly why I go there, I know why did I choose to leave my home and so on. But from outside observer's perspective, if I don't know your motivation, I don't know your work habits, I don't know where you work, for practical purposes, I may assume that you move randomly around. That's exactly what was not the case when we were able to measure the data. The first thing what we discovered is that the distances we cover from person to person follows the same power laws that the business does or our social networks does, is that most people tend to move very little in a certain neighborhood mostly, and then other individuals travel very, very large distances on a daily basis, and the number of individuals who travel very little or travel a lot follow precisely the same laws that we saw earlier, follow power laws. So it is by no means random. Hmm. The next question we ask is to say, okay, fine, our mobility is not random. Does it have predictive power? That is, can I really predict where you're going to be tomorrow at 3 p.m.? And for that, once again, we collected data from a number of individuals, for about 100,000 individuals, about daily patterns for several months, mobility pattern, and the results really surprised us. What we learned is that most individuals had a predictability of about 93%. What does that mean? It means that if I get access to your whereabouts, let's say hourly whereabouts for the last 3 months, I could in principle build a piece of software that will tell you with 93% exactness where you're going to be tomorrow at 3 p.m., which means that out of 100 trials, I will make a mistake 7 times, but 93 times I will get it right. We also learned, which was equally surprising, is that there was nobody under 80%, which meant that, you know, which had an interesting meaning for me because, you know, I thought I have a very regular pattern on a daily basis. You know, I go to the office, I go to certain cafeterias, I go to restaurants, mm-hmm. and pretty much everybody in my family and in my group knows exactly where I'm at a certain moment except when I'm traveling. So I'm very, very predictable. But I thought, there's this cool girl next door, you know, who is really seems to be completely spontaneous. She seems to be coming and going at random times with random friends and so on. So, you know, so while I'm predictable, she's not, perhaps. And there are many other people out there who are not predictable. Well, the results indicated that, if you want to think it this way, that if you stop in the street and you look at your left and you look at your right, and you see people of different race, different age, different gender, and so on, you can assume that they are roughly not more than 5% less or more predictable than you are. Hmm. We are all terribly predictable.
Yeah, reading about that made me feel better about being such a creature of habit.
I had the same feeling about that, to be honest. And the interesting thing was that we said, well, you know, perhaps we adults are like that, but students, you know, college students, they must be terribly spontaneous. So a colleague of mine, Sandy Pentland from MIT, has given, you know, about 100 students mobile phones. They were really cool gadgets back then, and the only request they had towards them is that they get this free gadget, but we will collect data about their whereabouts and communications and so on, so we can learn about human behavior. And obviously, each of the students agreed to that deal. And so then, you know, he started to study how predictable these college students are. You know, these are the transcenders. If any segment of the society should be spontaneous, it should be them. Well, it turned out that they showed anywhere between, you know, 85 to 95% predictability. And this 95% meant that about, you know, 5% of the time we were not sure where they are. And the unpredictable moments were really only on Friday and Saturday nights. Hmm. The rest of the week, the students were terribly predictable. We knew exactly where we're going to be at certain moments. So, you know, even the segment of the population that we think they should be the most spontaneous shows a huge amount of regularity in their daily mobility patterns.
So what do you think about free will?
Well, do we have free will? I think we do. Do we use it? Well, not always, and not for things that, you know, you would think that you could be using it for. So, yes, in principle, I could simply hang up this phone and, you know, just leave my job and leave my house and start living under the bridge here in Boston. But I don't do that. And, you know, at the end, many people have the choice to, you know, to change their life and do something completely different. But in the end, you know, very rarely we live with that. Now, even if you do a change of pattern, you just go from one regular pattern to some other one. Let's assume that you leave college and you start a job. Let's assume that you change jobs. That doesn't change your regularity fundamentally. What it changes is that may change your pattern. Maybe you're not going to go at 9 o'clock, but you're going to go at noon at work or at 6 a.m. at work or whatever the nice little job is. But you will settle very, very fast into a new pattern. And even on the weekends, we thought, okay, fine, people have very regular schedules during the week, but weekends, they're going to be spontaneous. Well, it turned out that people had just as much predictability over the weekend as they did during the week time. And typically, the only time where we had the lowest predictability were the transition times, you know, like the evening times or the morning times where people going from one location to the other one, because there's always some uncertainty about that. And also, that's the time when we choose to do things differently. On the way home, we may stop at the place we didn't stop before. We may do some shopping that at a place we never went before. So the transition times are the most unpredictable. But the transition times really reflect a very, very small percentage of the overall amount of time frame that, you know, it's our disposal. So at the end, they really don't affect significantly our predictability.
We were speaking a little bit earlier about some of the practical applications for this kind of knowledge. And one thing I found fascinating in the book were the studies that looked first at how cash, money, travels around from place to place, from person to person, and also a comparison that was made to how disease spreads.
Absolutely. So one of the, I mean, obviously the question is, you know, why do we do that? Why do we need to understand human behavior? And it turns out that lots of processes that surround us depend on our whereabouts and our predictability. You know, let's talk about, for example, commerce. You know, where we are affects about our choices of what we're going to buy, you know, where we're going to shop and so on. But there is also a major societal importance is because, you know, whether we want it or not, we actually carry diseases with us. But not only diseases, we carry ideas with us. And our mobility affects both the spread of diseases and the spread of ideas. And if anything, the most successful application of our predictability of human behavior came through the study of H1N1. So H1N1 was this virus that was somewhat scary about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And what lets people know about that is that this has been the virus in the history of all viruses that has been the most precisely predicted by scientists. That is that in 2009, in the fall when the virus broke out, already in the spring, in May, there was a very accurate prediction program that told us that first H1N1 will peak out in October and not in December and January as epidemiology typically predicts. And that has a very important implication because it told us that the vaccine that will come against H1N1 will be late because that was scheduled for November. And, you know, everybody kind of laughed up these methodologies, and at the end they were completely right. H1N1 did peak out in October. The vaccine was too late, and there was lots of finger-pointing about that afterwards, and it did decay essentially by January and February. Why were we able to do that? Partly because the researchers, Alessandro Vespignani and Dirk Brockmann from the University and from Northwestern University, have really used the regularity of human behavior. Their methodologies relied on, you know, on flight data and commuting data and travel data of individuals, and they were able to predict with several people preciseness, saying tomorrow or next week there will be 10 more people with H1N1 in Boston, you know, 20 in Houston, and so on. It worked incredibly well. So this is one area where, you know, understanding human behavior really matters, not because of H1N1, because H1N1 luckily wasn't as deadly or as bad as people have expected. But what we can count for is that the emergence of the next deadly virus is not a question of whether it will emerge or not, but when it will emerge. There will be some, and they will actually escape and then come loose. So therefore, we have to really be prepared to understand how they spread so that we can prepare the society for containing it. Because what we know about viruses is that if a new strain of a virus emerges, it takes months to develop an antidote, to develop any type of drug against or any type of vaccine. the only chance we have from saving humanity if it's a very deadly virus is containment. In order to do containment, we must be able to know where it's spread and where it's going to go next.
So I guess this is sort of a double-edged sword, but what use is this predictive technology to, say, law enforcement?
Well, I guess one of the biggest consumers, I'm assuming, will in the long term be both law enforcement and also commercial sites who try to predict, you know, shopping behavior and so on. But law enforcement is, you know, there are many edges to this problem. And you know, predicting human mobility and people's whereabouts and anomalies for that is an important issue for fighting terrorism. Because if you understand what is the normal pattern, you can identify what are the deviations from the normal patterns, where do you have to deploy resources because people are behaving in an anomalous manner. So that's one area where this is important, but it's equally important for commerce because predicting human behavior really implies predicting shopping patterns, predicting whereabouts, and therefore, you know, one could increase profits if they do it right. Now, that being said, of course, particularly in the area of law enforcement, the predictability of human behavior raises a number of very important privacy issues because the question is that do we want to live in a world in which our future whereabouts is actually predicted or our future activity patterns is predicted? And I don't think there's a very easy answer to that question in the sense that we as a society have to grapple with that particular issue of saying the tools are becoming more and more predictive, the data is becoming available about our activity pattern. You know, how do we regulate this particular, the outcomes, the tools that come out of that so that we feel comfortable in the society in which we live in?
We have less than a minute left, but I wonder if people have been surprised, and I know that you didn't use personally identifiable data for a lot of your work, but are people surprised when you tell them how accurately you might be able to predict what they're going to do next or where they will go?
There are two different surprises that we encounter. One of them is the intellectual surprise, and there is also a tendency of shoot down the messenger where people through our work realize how much data is already collected about them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't think much about the different things we do that have electronic fingerprints and what did they add up to. But in reality, we live in a society in which our life can be reconstructed mostly by minute resolution through the many electronic fingerprints or electronic breadcrumbs that we leave behind. And the sum of that really makes us very, very predictable. And many individuals end up being surprised about that aspect as well. The fact that we can actually use this data to make predictions is an extra layer by which we should really be paying attention to what happens in the research of human behavior.
Albert Laszlo Barabasi is founding director of the Center for Network Science at Northeastern University. His latest book, out now in trade paperback, is called Bursts, The Hidden Patterns Behind Everything We Do, From Your Email to Bloody Crusades. Laszlo, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.